On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Scientists who believe we are on the road to an earthly hell of global warming, and that is the vast majority of scientists these days, are desperate to find a way to whack America with the 2x4 that will really wake it up to the danger they see. It's been tough, with a minority band of skeptics feeling a natural readiness to doubt. But the warning megaphone is growing. Al Gore's movie has been a surprise box office hit. New books are making the melting, baking, collapsing face of a changing planet vivid. NASA's chief weather scientist, James Hansen, has been at the center of the battle he calls an epic race against time. Up next on Point, James Hansen on global warming and the fight to win the public mind. We're joined from New York by James Hansen. He's top climate scientist at NASA and director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. His new essay, The Threat to the Planet, is in the forthcoming issue of the New York Review of Books. You can find a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. James Hansen, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
We've got a little history with you, sir. Last December, you put up a warning that we were at risk of creating a different planet than we've ever known. We asked to talk to you about it. NASA put a muzzle on. Now you're writing and talking. Is the muzzle off, James Hansen?
Yes, but that does remind me that I need to make clear that I'm speaking as a private citizen, not representing NASA or the government.
Point taken. There it is. Yet you've got a lot of experience in this field. Now you're looking at the new raft of books and the movie that have come out. We want to hear about how you connect the dots around the global warming threat, what you see in these new publications and films. But broad scale, James Hansen, do you think that public comprehension of what's going on, at least by your lights, is changing quickly enough to address the problem?
Well, that's what needs to be determined. It does need to change quite rapidly. I think we have to make fundamental changes in our direction this decade, and I don't mean we need to understand the problem this decade, but we need to make a change in the trajectory of our greenhouse gas emissions, and that requires some actions, and I think they're not going to happen unless the public understands it, because the representatives, it's just easier, our representatives in Washington, it's just easier for them to ignore the problem until the public puts enough pressure on them.
The hook that you're hanging your new essay on is two books and the movie. One by Tim Flannery, an Australian, The Weathermakers, How Man is Changing the Climate and What It Means for Life on Earth. Another by Elizabeth Colbert, who will join us later, her field notes from a catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And then Al Gore, the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth, The Planetary Emergency of Global Warming and What We Can Do About It. James Hansen, give us a sense from these two books and movie. What do you see unfolding here, the picture that's being painted? Take us into what you've read and seen when you read and view these books and movie.
Well, I think they're very very helpful books, because they point out some of the major issues that are involved here. In the case of Tim Flannery's book, he makes clear the impact on species, the fact that if we continue down a business-as-usual path, we could end up causing the extinction of about half the species on the planet. It brings home, I think, to the public just how important this is, and the fact that it's a moral issue as well as a practical economic one.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth's book, it takes place in the polar region, places where we're beginning to see effects very clearly, and in effect, both the issue of extinction of species becomes very prominent there, because we're pushing the species there off the planet. There's no place colder for them to migrate to. And also the fact that the ice sheets are located at these high latitudes, and the impact of melting of those ice sheets on sea level is the second big irreversible change that we could bring about if we don't change the trajectory that we're on.
And what about the film? Al Gore's film, it's certainly not in all cinemas, but it's done very well in the cinemas that it's in. It's turning a lot of heads. What do you think of the message there?
Well, that is also very useful because we have to reach all the public. And not all of the public is reading these books. The movie, I think, does a good job of being honest in the science but presenting it in a way that is understandable. And so I hope that it will get into more movies so that the larger part of the public will see it.
Into more cinemas. Here's another scene from An Inconvenient Truth. Here's Al Gore giving his now famous PowerPoint presentation made into a movie here on the effects of global warming.
I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America. This is Patagonia, 75 years ago, and the same glacier today. This is Mount Kilimanjaro, 30 years ago, and last year. Within the decade, there will be no more snows of Kilimanjaro.
This is really not a political issue so much as a moral issue. Temperature increases are taking place all over the world,
and that's causing stronger storms.
Al Gore, as he said, used to be the next president of the United States. James Hansen, what about the leadership issue here? I mean, you said something already in just our first few minutes talking, that in this decade, by your lights, we not only have to identify the problem, that's identified, we have to act on it in a significant way. Tim Flannery in his book says, if we go on with business as usual, we may have 60% species extinction. And even if we go to a pretty radical alternate scenario, we're going to lose 20% of today's species. Do you see the leadership out there globally, nationally, to make that kind of change on that kind of timetable?
No, I don't. We will need to be very upfront with the public. For example, to get onto a path where we have declining emissions, we're going to have to make energy and fossil fuels more precious. And I don't see politicians who are willing to explain this in a frank, honest way to the public.
It more doesn't precious
need
meaning
to
more
be
expensive.
Painful, and it doesn't need to harm our economy. But we will have to make fuels more expensive. We can have a revenue-neutral carbon tax, for example, or fuel tax, so that we would give rebates to everybody. And if they choose to use those rebates on filling a gas guzzler, then they can do that. But most people would, in fact, say, well, I think I will use a more efficient vehicle and other appliances and things and save that money. But we have to do something like that because we've got to actually reduce the CO2 emissions, not just stop them, not just keep emitting them at the present rate, but we've got to reduce that.
A lot of people saying that it can quickly sound it can sound wonky in a hurry and get mocked for that. But you're making very vivid in this essay, and I've never quite seen it put this way before. You say that the United States has a heavy moral and legal responsibility for what's happening, that of all CO2 emissions in the world, the U.S. is responsible for almost 30%, much larger than the next closest. China and Russia, each less than 8%. You're saying, James Hansen, that if this goes forward and big parts of countries start to disappear underwater, people die, species die, the U.S. may be held legally and morally responsible. You say, will our children, as adults in the world, carry a burden of guilt as Germans carried after World War II, however unfair the inherited blame may be? That's a pretty serious prospect you raise.
Yeah, I think we need to look at the numbers. As I indicate there, we have emitted about 30% of carbon dioxide that fossil fuel use has caused so far. But our obligation actually runs, and our responsibility runs deeper than that, because we have also discouraged the achievement of international agreements that would lead to the solving of this problem. And so if we continue on this path, I think that we will be held eventually accountable for this. I mean, it's not too late. I think we have a narrow window of time now to begin to act on this problem. And, you know, I also point out in this essay that there have been world crises in the past where we were slow to enter the fray, but we did.
World War II, World War I.
We earned gratitude rather than disrespect and obligations. So I think we can still do that, but we need to inform the public and begin to take actions now.
We'll hear in just a couple of minutes from Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer with The New Yorker. But right now, Edward's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. My question is, first of all, to answer your question, is yes, I read Tim Flannery, and I also followed James Hansen's, efforts, and I appreciate both very much. And they converted me to a more, hard point of view in support of what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
The question I have for James Hansen is pretty simple. What's wrong with your colleagues, both at NASA and environmental science and in general? And if I can just use the anecdote that I gave your screener, which is, if this administration is saying that a 1% risk of terrorism means that you should treat it as certainty, and
you're referring to the Dick Cheney comment, 1%
exactly.
Means forget everything else,
How can there be any uncertainty given the amount of scientific evidence? And look, I studied, worked in physics and computer science for 25 years. I just don't understand what's wrong with your colleagues, James Hansen.
Let us pick that up.
Give me an idea.
Yes, James Hansen, Edward says, what's wrong with your colleagues? And I should say, you can go online right now and find all kinds of James Hansen bashing, people saying that you've backed off yourself, that you got it wrong, that you've said it's wrong, that you've got conflicts of interest. I mean, there's every sort of attack on you and your own view of global warming here. Edward wants to know, he says, what's wrong with your colleagues?
Yeah, I think there's enough blame to spread around, and scientists deserve part of the blame. I think we've been perhaps too clinical in describing the threat to the planet and not making clear that if we go down the business-as-usual path, we will end up with a different planet. And I think the media deserves some of the blame because they continue to present what they call a balanced picture in which they put on scientists who explain the problem and then some contrarians who deny the problem. And this may be a natural journalistic trait, but it's no longer appropriate because the science is no longer balanced. It's now become very clear. But
what about the implicit piece, though, in Edward's question that he's saying, what's wrong with your colleagues, meaning there are other scientists out there who are saying something different. Now, are they wrong? Are they corrupt? Are they so few that they don't matter?
Saying something different. The problem is they're getting an unfair hearing. And partly this, what I learned is that this is largely due to the influence of special interests. Because I was about to go on public radio, and I was told that I would need to be accompanied by a contrarian.
That was our show that you were about to go on.
No, it was not a different show.
Okay, excuse me.
But the producer told me.
Oh, I see.
This is essential that we have to do this. We have to present a balanced perspective. And as it turns out, I learned that the contributors and the advertisers include special interests who demand that there be a balanced presentation of this problem, and so. As a result, the public remains confused. They don't have what I would describe as an accurate picture of where the science stands. It looks as if there's still a big argument as to whether global warming is occurring and to whether the humans are causing it. Well, in fact, it has become very clear.
And how does that break down? You know, is it a majority, a slender majority, a vast majority of scientists who now share that view?
Oh, certainly a vast majority. 99% of scientists realize that it is true that the Earth is getting warmer, and that humans are at least to a substantial degree responsible for that. The problem is this does not translate over into Congress, for example. We have senators like Senator James Inhofe, the chairman of the Committee on Environment and Public Works, he describes this as the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on American people. Well, yeah, he received a substantial amount of support from fossil fuel industry. And what he says is not, in fact, consistent with what the National Academy of Science would say or what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would say. They have come to very clear conclusions. And yet these conclusions are simply ignored by such politicians.
And there was a time, maybe still now in some cases, when scientists making this case may pay a price themselves. You've paid some yourself. Al Gore talks about that in An Inconvenient Truth.
I've seen scientists who were persecuted, ridiculed, deprived of jobs, income, simply because the facts they discovered led them to an inconvenient truth.
It sounds like Al Gore is speaking from another planet there, but we know that time. Maybe Al Gore paid some of that price himself. Maybe he brought it on himself. James Hansen, do you think a politician can bring this message to the public, a public that likes its air conditioners and big cars and lifestyle, and not get hooted out of the polling booth?
Well, that's the question. Frankly, I think they could. In the draft of my article for the New York Review of Books, I said one of the problems is we don't have a Winston Churchill, and I meant someone who would make clear in a way that the public could understand what is needed. It does require, in a sense, some sacrifice, although, as I say, on the long run, it's actually in our economic best interests to begin to do something about this. That's the question. Can the public be sufficiently well educated and understand this well enough to realize that some actions will be needed in order to solve the problem? And that's what that's why these books and this movie are important.
And we're not talking a century from now, says James Hansen. We're talking really right now. I want to turn to the author of one of the books reviewed by Jim Hansen in the New York Review of Books upcoming issue. Elizabeth Colbert joins us from Williamstown, Massachusetts. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, author of the new book Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. Elizabeth Colbert, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jim Hansen writes about being on Larry King's interview show, and Larry King said to him, "Nobody cares about 50 years from now." What have you found since you've been out with these articles, this book, Elizabeth? Do you see people responding in a manner equivalent to the challenge here?
Well, I mean, on the one, you know, sort of prima facie, obviously we haven't responded, as Jim has pointed out, on a level equivalent to the challenge, which is absolutely impossible to exaggerate. I do think there is a growing number of people for whom this is the central issue of our time. And as that grows, one can hope that that will influence our political system. But I think it's true, you know, what you guys were discussing before, that we really need to reach a very, very wide audience to have an impact here.
It can still sound far away. And if you think 50 years is far away, that's not such a long horizon in these terms. You've been out there kind of on the edge of this in the last few years and writing about it. What have you seen? What makes it most vivid? What examples of the changes going on now do you find, Elizabeth, drive it home to audiences?
Well, the changes are most dramatic right now in the Arctic, although they are really becoming, you know, measurable virtually anywhere on the planet. But if you go up to Alaska, for example, where this is an issue that, you know, there's increasingly little debate, even though politically Alaska is quite conservative. Everyone sees it in their own lives. They will tell you it's gotten warmer. They can see that the permafrost is thawing. You used to be able to do these ice roads in the winter for oil exploration, and the time in which you can, you know, make these ice roads has been cut in half in the last 30 years, for example. So when you go up there, for example, one of the places I went was a tiny town that is quite literally disappearing. It used to be protected by sea ice from storms in the fall, and now the sea ice doesn't come in until much, much later. Sometimes it, you know, barely comes in at all. And these storms come up and they're just destroying several islands up there. And whole communities are now talking about moving.
James Hansen, you say that the one way you try to get this across to people is by talking about, let's say, a pair of dice and rolling those dice and what that means in terms of the advance of global warming. Can you share that illustration with us?
Well, yeah. Back in the 1980s, I showed dice that were representative of that period of time, which had, using the definition of the National Weather Service as to what is an unusually warm season, you'd have two sides of the dice painted red for warm, for unusually warm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now the probability of having a season that warm is 60 to 70%, which is equivalent to having four sides of the six sides of the dice red. So the warming is not yet as large as the natural fluctuations, but it's large enough that it's affecting the probabilities. And the problem is that there's more warming in the pipeline even if we stopped increasing the greenhouse gases now. So there's an inertia of the system, and that's why there's a danger that the system can begin to run out of our control if we don't begin to take actions now, because there are larger changes in the pipeline. And that's why we have to slow down the experiment.
Elizabeth Colbert writes about the changes happening right now. You remind us, Jim Hansen, that there have been mass extinctions of life on Earth before, periods where between 50 and 90% of the species on Earth disappeared. Of course, these things happened over hundreds of thousands of years, and life came back. Humans came out of that. You're now saying that in a much shorter frame of time, 50 years, a century, a couple of centuries, we could see a different planet. If we stay on the business-as-usual path, what would that planet look like?
The business-as-usual path by the end of this century would imply global warming of about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. That would make the Earth has not been that warm since the middle of the Pliocene, about 3 million years ago. And at that time, sea level was about 80 feet higher than it is now. So that's one of the impacts. The question of the impact on species.
80 feet, on board, that would mean goodbye what? Goodbye Boston, New York, Philly, Florida, Washington, Miami. I mean, that means and much more lost in other low-lying countries.
Yeah. Now, the issue about sea level, you can look at the impact of a given warming in the long term. Then the question is, how long does it take for that to occur? It used to be thought that it took millennia. The more we look at the history of the Earth, the more we realize that the response time is probably no longer than a few centuries. And there are several cases in which sea level went up at a rate of 1 meter every 20 years. So that's more than 3 feet of sea level rise every 20 years, and that continued for several centuries. So that's what we need to be concerned about, how fast we will begin to get disintegration of the ice sheets. And the evidence that we're beginning to get from the field is not encouraging. What's happening on Greenland, for example, is that in the summer the area with melt has increased about 50%, and that meltwater goes down the crevasses and to the base of the ice sheet, lubricates the ice sheet, and it begins to move and send icebergs to the ocean more rapidly. And the flux of these icebergs has doubled in the last several years. We're beginning to measure around the world. There are seismometers which are measuring earthquakes. Well, they're finding earthquakes on Greenland, and what they are is ice quakes. A portion of the ice sheet begins to surge forward, and then it grinds to a halt on the rocky land. But the number of these ice quakes doubled between 1993 and 1999, and now it has doubled again. In 2005, it had been 7 in 1993 and 14 in 1999, and 30, or more than 30 last year. So the effect of this, and we also have this gravity satellite, which has measured the change in the mass of the Greenland ice sheet. And last year, the Greenland decreased by the equivalent of 50 cubic miles of ice. Well, that's not very much when you spread it out over the world ocean. It's only half a millimeter. But the thing is that it's increasing rapidly as this warming increases. Mm-hmm. And it's a question of how many more years can we go down this path until it becomes unstable and we lose a large part of the ice sheet. Mm-hmm. Then we're talking about meters of sea level rise. So it's a big issue.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Elizabeth Colbert, Jim Hansen's talking about big expanses of time. You've been out there recently looking at it. Is it obvious?
I think, as I said, it's obvious in certain parts of the world. It is becoming increasingly obvious in the Arctic, and when you go up there, people will tell you it's obvious. And I think that the problem here is, you know, how as you point out, how long in the future can people think? And it's a pretty sad comment when you think about the history of this country and how much forethought our predecessors had, the people who founded this country have, when we say, well, 50 years is really a long time. Mm. I don't have to think about that. 50 years is, as you point out, is not a very long time. Many of us still hope to be here 50 years from now, and certainly our children will still be here 50 years from now. And a culture that can't think 50 years down the road doesn't even want to think 50 years down the road. That's a pretty depressing thought.
Did you find people out on the edge where this is more evident sort of telling you, Elizabeth, take back the word, people living with this already in their backyards or on the shoreline?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. The native people up in Alaska, up in northern Canada, absolutely. They say, please, tell our story to the world, because a whole way of life that has persisted for thousands of years, which is a way of life at the edge of the land and the ice, is disappearing. Absolutely, it is disappearing. And it's, some people would argue it's even a human rights issue. There are human rights lawsuits in the works. But really, what they want, absolutely, is for people to go back and tell the story. And unfortunately, these are very remote places often, and life has been very unchanged for millennia. So people don't get there very much. So that was one of the interesting parts of writing this book, to go to those places and see that world disappearing. And it's very sad.
Right now, John is calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Elizabeth James. Great show. We need more programs like this. I'm a professor that studies the health issues in the Canadian Arctic, and one of the most frightening statistics or studies there is that the Inuit contain the highest levels of toxicity of any mammals on the planet, and the breast milk of some of the women in the eastern Arctic of Canada and Greenland is actually considered a hazardous waste.
Is it related to global warming?
Yes, it has.
How?
It has to do with the pollution traveling north in the wind and ocean currents, and then getting trapped in their ancestral diets, which they consume, and then it gets trapped in their bodies. And if that's not a wake-up call to Americans, I don't know what will be.
Breast milk as a toxic threat doesn't sound too good.
Especially for, the next generation of their children. And they have nothing to do with it. This is not their problem.
John, what do you make of public attitudes, though? Do you see change underway here that might respond to the kind of... Really, James Hansen speaks in a very even-keel tone, but what he's saying is about as alarming as it can get.
Well, I really applaud their work, and Elizabeth's piece in the New York was fabulous. But what we need is leadership, and right now we lack that at the high level of our government. I mean, we need a wake-up call. We need someone like a Kennedy and a Moon mission, where we're all behind this. I mean, we need leadership, and until we get that, it's not going to change. We need more radicals, which means to get to the root of, that really speak out about this. So I applaud their work, and I'm doing as much as I can here. And I really am focusing on our next generation. We've got to help them through education, because we've screwed up this generation.
It may not look so radical soon. It may simply look necessary. John in Grand Rapids, thank you very much for your work and your call. Gwen's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say James Hansen is my hero, and I was most moved by his saying that he felt compelled to speak out despite being asked not to by the administration when he thought of a conversation with his grandchild somewhere down the road, looking him in the eye and saying, Grandpa, you understood what was coming. Why didn't you tell us?
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say it's terrifying. As you say, he speaks in a very even-keeled, very, neutral, scientific way. But the picture that he paints is terrifying, and I think it's hard for people to take on because it's so, difficult to imagine this kind of catastrophe that sounds like a Hollywood movie. I think what's important in these discussions, I mean, it's important, of course, for us to understand, to keep hearing again and again how dramatic the changes would be, but we need to act, and I think it would be really helpful for citizens, just normal people like myself, to hear more discussion about what we can do, what we have to do now, because I do hear James Hansen saying we have 10 years before it becomes irreversible.
So let's use them.
let's use them. And I mean, obviously, we need to get government to follow, if not lead. But what can we do now? And I just like to hear more about concrete suggestions. What can I do so I don't feel hopeless? So I feel like, okay, this is what I can do today. I am going to go out and replace my car with a hybrid.
But Gwen, we'll do that right now. We hear that and understand it. Let's go straight to it. Jim, Elizabeth?
Yes, could I? Please. I'd like to respond to that because that's one of the things which I felt is not adequately explained. I mean, there too often the books will end up saying, well, you can do this. You can buy a hybrid. You can replace a light bulb with a more efficient one. The individual actions are not going to solve the problem. They're important, and we need to understand that that's the kind of thing that's needed. But if individuals are all that responds, what that does is it reduces the cost of fuel because, obviously, and
demand
other people
drops,
will
yep.
use it.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be leadership on the national and international level. There have to be, as I explained, you will have to make fuel more precious so that people conserve it.
But that's a euphemism. You need to speak more plainly, if I may be so bold. When you say make it more precious, you mean make it more expensive.
Make it more expensive.
You mean up the price of gasoline?
Yes. That doesn't mean that you will need to pay more for the fuel because you do this slowly over time. You increase the price, and at the same time, you make products available that are much more efficient so that you don't actually have to pay more for the fuel. But the price per gallon is going to be higher.
So the number one thing in response
to
Gwen's question, you're saying—
We need to stretch the conventional fossil fuels so that they last several decades because if we continue to just burn them at willy-nilly at the rate we are, then we're going to be going into non-conventional fossil fuels, tar sands, heavy oil, shale oil.
Even dirtier.
And squeezing oil out of coal. And in that case, we're going down the business-as-usual path, and the planet is going to suffer. So we need national and international leadership. And, this has happened before. We were faced with a different threat in the case of the ozone layer.
Mm-hmm.
It was not as difficult to solve because it was chemicals, not as essential to the economy and as the energy is. But we followed a path internationally. The United States took a leadership role. Mm-hmm. We recognized that developing countries deserved special treatment because we had refrigerators. We could not tell China and India that they are not allowed to have refrigerators. Mm-hmm. So we gave them an extra 10 years. But we did phase out the chlorofluorocarbons, and we solved that problem. And it's very analogous now. And that was the attempt of the Kyoto Protocol. We were going to have a clean development mechanism that would encourage energy efficiency in China and India, but we turned our backs on that attempt. But we can't continue to do that. We have to face up to the problem.
Elizabeth, Jim Hansen says, number one thing you can do is raise the price of fuel, and you can't do that individually. That would take leadership in our country. That means, essentially, he's saying to Gwen, the first thing you can do is elect leaders, political leaders, who will advocate more efficient uses of energy, but also higher prices of energy. Is that going to happen?
Well, I absolutely agree with Jim, who knows more about this subject really than probably anyone on the planet. You need a structural changes, and those are not going to happen by changing your light bulbs. What I would like to say, though, because I have been out on the road talking to people who care very deeply about this issue, and people do want to take action, and they consider just sort of sitting here and waiting for a change in the administration to be something that they don't want to just do. And I totally agree with that. And the one thing that I would encourage people to do, besides changing your light bulb, which although despite the price elasticity problems, I do encourage you to do that. I do encourage you to drive smaller cars because that also creates markets for these products. But there are many, many communities that are trying to implement community-wide, statewide even, greenhouse gas reduction programs. And what those do, while they do not solve the problem, they create a different political climate. And that is what we need. And we cannot waste any time. We can't waste the time between now and even 2008, which will be absolutely a critical election to the future of the planet. I think there's no doubt about that.
Look big scale. Look top politics. Jonathan's calling from San Diego, California. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
We're well. What do you think, Jonathan?
All right. Well, from one of your last shows with Tom Friedman, I got up on the show and I pointed out that we needed to go and change our influence, especially in Hollywood. What I've done was that Tom Friedman had strengthened my resolve, and I brought it to a school level at the school that I'm attending at a college.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of the leaders of my student government. In fact, I'm trying to reinstitute it on a president level. And what I'm trying to influence the students at my school is that, you know, hey, the threat is real and that we need to take responsibility in creating positive influences to create the best amount of change, especially of people in my generation.
Do you think your generation will be different, Jonathan? Will they take this on more aggressively? Can they do it soon enough?
I think they can do it soon enough, but we need to do it on a school level while they're at school. As some of your previous callers and even some of your guests have pointed out, that it starts at an educational level, and students leading that effort says, you know, hey, to the other students, that it is fine to think this way, and it is fine to think radically, that this is something that is going to be facing in our lifetimes.
So jump on it and jump on it right now. Jonathan, thanks very much for your call. James Hansen, we're nearly to the end of our time. What is it that you hope to say to your grandchildren? What is it you fear we may say to our grandchildren?
Well, you know, responding to one of the earlier comments about the high latitudes, the Arctic, it is still possible even to save the Arctic, in my opinion, but it would require not only slowing the rate of carbon dioxide emissions, but also reducing these pollutants that are causing the kind of problems that we heard about, because these also contribute to the warming and contribute to the melting of ice. And so we need to reduce air pollution as well as the carbon dioxide emissions. Mm.
And the message you hope to give to your grandchildren that you fear we may give to our grandchildren?
Well, the message I hope that we can give to them is that we did start on the problem now, and we did minimize the problem. We're not going to completely eliminate it, but we can certainly avoid the really disastrous effects if we begin to take action now.
There's something to hope for, but it means acting. Maybe the public mind is preparing to do just that with the help from people like you. James Hansen, NASA's top climate expert, director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure.
And Elizabeth Colbert, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, staff writer for The New Yorker, joining us from Williamstown. Elizabeth, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is On Point.